We all know the tax code is too long, right? Too complicated? Or maybe it's just complicated enough. Did you ever think of that? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. September the 29th, I believe it is, Tuesday. Great as always to have you with us, everybody. The politics of the American tax code is where we begin today because we are at that point in the election cycle, that is sometime after the Iowa State Fair, but before any votes have been cast, where candidates go through the time-worn ritual, and I mean that every sense of the word, of spelling out how they would like to fix the tax code. The plans we've seen so far, the latest being that from Donald Trump yesterday, promised to streamline and minimize taxes, but are, truth be told, pretty light on details, and they don't usually go anywhere. If all of this sounds familiar, it's because we've all seen this movie before, as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports.
Looking at the U.S. tax code in all its complexities can be a pretty frightening prospect. But what if things were different? Scott Hodge is the president of the Tax Foundation.
In a world in the future in which we had a simpler tax code, you'd have a tax code that didn't punish success and one that everyone could understand.
Presidential campaigns love calling for tax reform, but those promises haven't often translated into policy changes. If you're losing revenue by lowering taxes, it's got to come from somewhere or someone.
Behind every provision and loophole and deduction in the tax code, there's a pretty substantial constituency of people and businesses that live on those things.
Not to mention the people who live off explaining those things. Troy Lewis is a CPA in Draper, Utah, and even his parents are calling asking about the candidate's plans.
Could you boil this down for me? Which one is going to reduce my taxes and put more after-tax spending ability in my wallet?
Lewis says that's why tax reform resonates so well on the campaign trail. Veronique DeRuggi is a senior fellow at the Mercatus Center.
Every presidential candidate always makes some noise about reforming the tax code, but I think there is something that's quite different this time around.
Or there will be, she says, if the next president takes the lead in a movie called Political Courage, which sounds more like a biopic than a horror film. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
There's media news of note today. The digital news site Business Insider has been bought by Berlin-based Axel Springer. Springer's already a big player over in Europe. It runs a number of newspapers and websites. The company said it was time to get into the U.S. market. They did so for a relative bargain in a deal that speaks volumes about media valuations in this digital day and age. Marketplace's Nova Sappho has that story.
Business Insider is now valued at $390 million. That's a lot of money if you're a newspaper.
You could buy the Washington Post and probably the Boston Globe, too.
For that same money, says Rick Edmonds. He's a media business analyst at the Poynter Institute. But Business Insider was a relative bargain compared to Vox Media, for example, which was last valued at $850 million, or BuzzFeed, valued at $1.5 billion, and Vice, $2.5 billion. All these sites have secured investments from big media conglomerates during the past couple of years. So what's the attraction?
Your audience is going to tilt younger, and that's a sort of a good thing as you look into the future.
Ad dollars are in search of young, impressionable eyeballs, and they've been skewing digital, accounting for more than a quarter of all media advertising. But most of those ads aren't going to news sites.
The values are all more based on the potential down the road.
That's Susan Bedell, a senior analyst at Forrester Research. Bedell says there's value in what digital media companies can do now. They're good at getting and keeping young audiences on mobile and social media. BuzzFeed is one of the most popular mobile apps with 18 to 34-year-olds, right along Tinder and Snapchat. And in the case of Business Insider, Bedell says, they've grabbed an important niche, a young and techie audience of some 76 million a month.
You need to know what Business Insider is writing about because that's what everyone's going to be talking about that day. And Silicon Alley and Silicon Beach and, you know.
That's also known as New York and Los Angeles. I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
In New York today, down at the lower end of Manhattan Island, traders were just kind of marking time. Don't quite know what they were waiting for. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. learned this morning, courtesy of the S&P Case-Shiller Home Price Index, that the American housing market continues to do all right. Prices are up an average of 5% over a year ago. In some places, they're downright booming. Places like San Francisco and New York and Seattle, cities where full-time workers can't even afford to rent close in anymore. All of that spells trouble for the group most drawn to urban neighborhoods and the group, we are told, that is most important to the future health of real estate in this country, first-time buyers in their 20s and early 30s. Most of them can finally afford a down payment and a monthly mortgage now, but where can they afford to settle down? From Portland, Oregon, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has that story.
It doesn't get much hipper than this. Portland's trendy Division Street, a busy urban strip lined with new apartment buildings, funky clothing stores, a $4 per scoop gourmet ice cream parlor where there's always a line halfway down the block.
Get your orange and olive oil. It's one of our seasonal flavors.
I step through the glass and steel doors of Inhabit, a boutique realty office next to a yoga studio and a brew pub where broker Eric Hagstedt presides.
So you have a local grocery store, you have parks, public transportation, all at your fingertips. And that's what's driven our prices so high, because people want this lifestyle.
How high for this lifestyle?
A new condominium home or townhome, easily $400 a foot.
What does $400 a foot translate into, let's say, a 1,500 square foot?
$500,000.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, wow. Because $500,000 to buy a modest two-bedroom apartment is not in the price range of most first-time buyers. Which doesn't mean they don't want to buy. According to consumer surveys, well over three-quarters of people in their 20s and early 30s do plan to own someday. And more of them are now in a position to buy because the job market's strong and interest rates remain low. Except home prices are going up, especially for all those minimalist condos and renovated row houses in desirable central cities. Won't that affordability crunch just kill young people's chances to finally become homeowners? Not really, says economist Robert Dietz at the National Association of Home Builders.
In medium size and smaller metro areas, you know, the traditional single family home in the suburb remains popular.
Partly because it's cheaper. The typical American starter home, most likely in a suburb, costs just $168,000. Housing analyst Jed Kolko at UC Berkeley says it is true.
There's been an increase in college-educated young adults living in very dense urban neighborhoods. Smart young things living in Brooklyn, in downtown San Francisco.
But the idea that most young people are striving for this urban lifestyle?
It's not true of that generation overall. They are actually less likely to be living in urban neighborhoods as opposed to suburban areas today than that same age group in 2000.
So where are most of them settling down and buying, at least those who can now afford to?
Morning. Come on in. Hello, guys. Christian. Say hi.
Hi.
Hi. And then this is Eden, and my oldest is Grace.
Wow, this is the house.
Oh. It was. Yeah. A lot of decorating to be done yet. But.
Yes.
Financial analyst Josh Reif, age 30, is welcoming me to his family's new five-bedroom, 2,800-square-foot house. It's on a winding street in a picture postcard housing development about 40 miles from downtown Portland. There are farms and timberland all around. Josh works at a local bank. Wife Chelsea is a stay-at-home mom. They have three kids, and she also publishes a food blog part-time. She says for more than a decade, they rented, trying to save, living in cramped spaces.
We were quickly growing too large for our other home. You know, we just felt like we needed to get the kids into a home that they could grow up in with more space and in a neighborhood where there would be kids their age.
They got this house for $260,000 with a mortgage under 4% and a two-car garage. They admit it's a little sleepy out here. Josh loves gourmet coffee, and he has to get his fix near work in Portland. Still, he says the burbs feel right for now.
Just looking for a good, homey, secure spot. I mean, hey, we'd love to have a quirky little place in Portland with lots of character and history and everything else, right? But I'm not willing to pay an extra $300,000 for that right now. Right now, I just need space for my kids.
Space for family at an affordable price, likely the mantra for more and more young people as they emerge from their recessionary 20s into financial adulthood. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The big bugaboo in higher education right now, aside from maybe the cost of it, which we all know is nothing to be sneezed at, the big bugaboo is trying to get more people from all slices of society into the most competitive schools. To that end, a coalition of 80 of those schools, including all the Ivies and the big-name public universities, has a new application process. And if you're thinking right now, wait a minute, wasn't the common application already supposed to streamline that whole process? The answer is yes. But this new platform, the Coalition for Access, Affordability, and Success, it's called, is supposed to be better. How's that going to go? Marketplace's Sally Herships is on that one.
Applying to college, it's like the high school version of doing your taxes. But it is also stressful for the schools, like recently when there were major tech problems with the common application.
With lost applications or system outages during peak periods.
Jeff Alderson is with EduVentures.com. The company researches higher ed. He says the tech issues were a big deal, especially for elite schools.
A lot of the institutions that have a lot of brand cachet and have a lot riding on how smooth their application process goes year over year.
So they created their own application platform, the Coalition for Access, Affordability, and Success. The goal is a platform that works and, as its name suggests, to make college affordable and accessible for all students. The coalition says one way it will do that is its private members will provide students with full financial aid if they need it.
It may be helpful, but you know, it's simply going to, I think, to some students appear as another choice.
Morralee Keller is with the National College Access Network. It helps students get access to college, especially low-income and minority students. She says the best way to help underrepresented groups get into school is for the schools to find more ways to accept more of them.
And I'm not sure an application platform is the best way or the most innovative way to make that happen.
Schools will still use the Common App. Keller says for students, the application process is already confusing, and this could make it even worse. Jeff Alderson says if schools are really serious about lowering barriers, they should make the college application fee itself free. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Coming up,
we don't venture into, as other countries have under economic stress, fascism or communism or some other kind of ism.
Which gets us to optimism. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 47 points today, 0.3%, closed at 16,049. The NASDAQ down 26 points, about 0.5%, finished at 4517. The S&P 500 gained 2 points, up about 0.1%, 18.84 there. European digital publisher Axel Springer, as we were telling you, gave back 4.25% today on news that it agreed to buy Business Insider. Fiat Chrysler was dinged by U.S. auto safety regulators today. Fiat Chrysler down about 0.5%. Ford Motor Company gained 0.2%. The Canadian drug company Valeant Pharmaceuticals was still under the weather on news that U.S. lawmakers want answers about its big price increases for two heart drugs. Valeant down 4.4% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.05%. And you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Once it figures out that whole leadership thing it's working on and decides whether there's going to be a government shutdown or not, the House of Representatives is expected to vote sooner rather than later on a bill that would get rid of a 40-year-old ban on exporting American crude oil. The restrictions were a reaction to the OPEC oil embargoes back in 1973, but that market is really different now, thanks mostly to a dramatic increase in production here. So Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explores the growing momentum around lifting that ban.
Even now, the ban isn't a complete ban. There are exceptions, such as exporting to Canada. And just last month, the Commerce Department okayed trades with Mexico. We send them our light sweet crude in exchange for an equal number of barrels of their heavy sour crude. And those swaps are supposed to help both of our refineries run better. But there's also a big push to lift the ban entirely.
Who loves the ban on U.S. crude oil exports? Iran and Russia. Not exactly our best friends.
That ad was made by the American Petroleum Institute, a trade group that wants the ban lifted. API's Louis Finkel sums up the pitch for exporting like this.
It's going to create more jobs here at home. It's going to have a positive impact on our trade deficit. And most importantly, it's going to have a positive impact on consumers. That repealing the ban on crude exports is going to create downward pressure on gasoline prices and benefit all American consumers.
But some Democrats worry it'll raise energy prices and jeopardize national security. Many independent refineries, environmentalists, and unions are also in favor of maintaining the status quo. And the counterargument has a scary-sounding ad of its own.
Lifting the crude oil ban could raise gas prices, cost U.S. jobs, and help grow China's economy, while putting our energy future at greater risk from terrorists like ISIS by making us more dependent on Middle Eastern oil.
That was made by a group called Allied Progress. So what might lifting the ban actually do? Lynn Westfall is the director of the Office of Energy Markets and Financial Analysis at the Energy Information Administration. His nonpartisan agency recently put out a report on this, and he says at most by 2025...
We see effects on crude prices and therefore gasoline prices in the neighborhood of about a penny a gallon.
That's lowering prices a penny.
So it's not a big effect on prices consumers pay, but it's a fairly significant effect on the income of U.S. domestic crude producers.
He thinks it could eventually add up to $30 billion a year of additional income for U.S. crude producers, revenue that would come at the expense of domestic refineries. Westfall says this is the result of a couple of years of research and seven previous reports. He says case closed. But Ed Herz, an energy economist at the University of Houston, looks at all the research out there and is just not impressed that lifting the ban will do much of anything at all.
Until the United States gets to a point where crude oil is less expensive to produce than it is overseas, we can't compete dollar for dollar, barrel for barrel against the larger producers in OPEC.
Relative to some Middle Eastern oil-producing countries, it's harder and more expensive to pull oil out of the ground in the U.S.
U.S. producers with shale plays costing $25, $35, $45, $55, $65 a barrel to produce cannot compete with OPEC producers where the cost of lifting and producing crude oil is less than $10 a barrel.
But he says the ban is such a non-issue, he doesn't see much argument for keeping it in place either. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
There will be in this coming election season, because believe you me, it hasn't really started yet, there will be much talk of capitalism, of the wonders and the failures of our market economy. The latest book from Robert Reich, once a regular commentator on this program, then and now a professor of public policy at Berkeley, is all about that capitalism, warts and all. It's called Saving Capitalism. Bob, it's good to talk to you again.
Well, good to talk to you, Kai.
I don't want to question your choice of title on this thing, but Saving Capitalism kind of implies that it's broken, is it?
Yes. The people who love capitalism really don't like the title because they do think that I'm implying it's broken. And the people that hate capitalism say, well, why should it be saved? Look, it is broken in the sense that almost all the economic gains have gone to the top. Inequality is widening. And I think if we don't get serious about changing the rules of the game, and I want to get into this with you, hopefully, we're going to find ourselves with a capitalism that really is fundamentally not working for our people.
We will get into that, but I want to make it clear here that what you are arguing against in this book is not capitalism itself, the existence of it. It's not the free markets.
No. In fact, the kind of a central thesis of the book is that you cannot have a free market without government. I mean, government sets the rules of the market. What is property? What is contract? What kind of bankruptcies are allowed and what are not allowed? What market power is permissible and not permissible? The real issue is not a choice between the free market and government. The real issue is whether the market and government system that we have is working for most people or is working for an elite at the top. And unfortunately, these days, it does feel quite rigged.
You talk in the preface of this thing, Bob, about what this entire discussion used to be called, which is political economy. The terms of debate and, in fact, the rules of the game have changed.
Yes. And we have forgotten how politics shapes the economy, and therefore we don't feel comfortable any longer talking about the relationship between wealth and power. And yet, if we don't talk about that and if we don't acknowledge it, we're missing out on the biggest challenge we face.
Which is what?
Which is trying to get wealth and power away from each other, to try to limit the degree to which wealth can affect the rules of the market, how we actually run our market system. Right now, big money is calling a lot of the shots, and small businesses and individuals have a very, very hard time getting in.
You've been around, and I say this not pejoratively, you've been around a long time. In at the very top level.
Forever, Kai. I mean, before you were even an imaginary blink in your father's eye. Yes, I'm sorry.
I appreciate that. Thank you. You've been around for a while, shall we say, at the very
yes.
top levels of public policy in this country. And I confess I'm surprised you're not more skeptical about the ability to make any of these changes that you want to have happen, because you know the Congress of the United States, you know the American electorate, and the idea that you're going to pry power from you know the top 1% in this country is a little tough, but it's a little naive.
Well, I don't think so at all. If you look at history, every time capitalism gets way off course, Kai, the genius of the American system is that we sort of address the excesses, reform it, we put ideology aside, we roll up our sleeves, get on with what has to be done. We don't venture into, as other countries have under economic stress, fascism or communism or some other kind of ism. We really are very practical, and we'll do it again. I am a student of history. That makes me optimistic. I'm also optimistic because I am surrounded every day, blessedly, I count my lucky stars, by young people between the ages of 18 and 25 who are idealistic, and they are determined to make the system work.
There are some historical sort of personal parallels in this book, right? You talk about your father and his path to prosperity, and then you as a father watching your son try to make his way in this new version of capitalism that we have. Talk about that for a little while.
Well, my father was a small businessman. He had a couple of clothing shops. Those were the 50s and 60s. There was a great deal of optimism about the American economy. I mean, we were on the way to improving not only the economy for everyone, but everyone sensed in their own houses, in their own homes, in their own families, that their children would do better than they have done. I'm not sure we still have that same sense. Capitalism is not simply a selfish sport. It entails and necessitates a degree of trust, a degree of even generosity. It has a moral core. And if we lose that sense of trust and generosity and morality and ethics, then it's just simply dog-eat-dog. And we spend more and more and more, not on production, but on protection.
Robert Reich teaches public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. His most recent book is called Saving Capitalism for the Many, Not the Few. Bob, it's always good to talk.
Thank you, Kai.
Bob hooked us up with a bunch of digital extras before he left. He took some listener questions. We've got an excerpt of the book as well. It's all on our website, marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, in which, yet again, Ralphie Lifshitz gives me pronunciation agita. Mr. Lifshitz, better known perhaps as Ralph Lauren or Loren, somebody please help me take your pick, said today he's going to step down as CEO of his eponymous company. That would be Lauren or Loren, not Lifshitz. He's been doing that job for 48 years running that company. I've only been doing this one for 10, and I'll tell you what, more power to him. All righty, got to go. The Dow up 47 points today, about 0.3%. The NASDAQ down 26 points, about 0.5%. The S&P 500 went the other way, up 2 points, 0.1%. Caitlin Ash is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital producer is Tony Wagner, the senior digital producer around here is Nishat Kurwa. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.